Thanks a lot. And in general, I would like to thank Luca and Celine as well for having organized this this fantastic conference, as Adrian did before. So I join these acknowledgements. And so today I'm going to making a sort of a review and introduction to the subject of conjoint orbits. This is a topic that has been developed in the 60s and 70s, mainly by mathematicians. So there is an enormous amount of literature, especially on the math side. Here I made a sort of selection in case you want to, you will be interested at the end and you want to learn more. So the first two references are more mathematical, with a more mathematical oriented flavor. And the other two are more, say, from the physics literature, and in particular, I advertise also the PhD thesis of Blagoj Oblak that try to make a sort of merging between the math literature and more physics-oriented literature. And so one thing that I like is that here in this lecture by Kirillov, that was one of the pioneers of this topic, he presented as lectures on the orbit method, as we will see. So this is a setup that works very well in certain cases, but not exhaustive at all. So this is why he presented it as a method rather than a framework. And so the main questions I would like to answer during my talk is why is it interesting to study conjoint orbits? And the main issues is that conjoint orbits, for these methods, allow us to quantize the dynamics on classical phase spaces with symmetry. So if you wish, for instance, at the end of all Adrian's talk, we identified a asymptotic phase space, and on this asymptotic phase space, there were some symmetries acting. So the conjoint orbits methods gives you a way to quantize the dynamics on these phase spaces. So you can follow all the procedure of Adrian, you arrive at a phase space like this, and then you try to quantize it. Or as soon as you identify the relevant symmetries, you can directly start from this method. And this is something that this kind of approach we'll see later on during the conference in Rob's talk. And another important and crucial point is that this method gives you a way to build irreducible representations of non-compact and in particular of infinite dimensional groups. So this is a subject that is very hard to tackle also for mathematicians, build irreducible representation of infinite dimensional groups, but we have a lot of infinite dimensional groups that are relevant in physics and in gravity. And these methods give you a very nice way of build at least some of their irreducible representations. And I hope to have the time towards the end of this review to at least show you how this work, all of these works in the case of the Virasoro group. And so how does these methods work? So the idea is that a conjoint orbit of a given group G, I'm going to decide to define it soon, is essentially a symplectic manifold with a G action. So this makes the connection with the first item in this list. So symplectic manifold with a G action is essentially a phase space on which some symmetry acts. And to make the contact with the second item, the fact is that as soon as you identify a conjoint orbit, there is a method to build a representation of G starting from it. And the idea is just that you use a geometric quantization, for instance, the tools of geometric quantization. To build a representation of G. And as I already said, this method is absolutely non-systematic. So not all conjoint orbits can be quantized, and not all irreducible representation can be obtained from the quantization of conjoint orbits, at least as far as it is known right now. Of course, there are some exceptions, but maybe not so interesting. And the only exception that I'm aware of is the one of nilpotent groups. In the case of nilpotent groups, all orbits are quantizable and all irreducible representations are obtained from the quantization of orbits. So it's a case that is not maybe hyper interesting, but nilpotent Lie algebras, so from where nilpotent groups can be obtained, are essentially central extensions of abelian Lie algebras. And the typical example is just the Heisenberg algebra of quantum mechanics. So in the case of the Heisenberg algebra, it's not extremely surprising because we know how to deal with quantum mechanics where we can essentially quantize the all orbits. But here I will try to point towards examples that are outside the realm of nilpotent groups. So in order to proceed, I have to define for you, first of all, what a coadjoint orbit is. And just to fix the notation, I will briefly recall you what are the adjoint and the coadjoint representation of a group. Okay, so the adjoint representation, I will denote like this, is a representation of a given group on its Lie algebra, while the coadjoint representation will be denoted like this. It will be a map, a representation of a group on the dual of its Lie algebra. And essentially to each group element, I will associate a matrix, an element of GLG that I will denote in this way. Okay, so now how can we define these maps? So this is just standard group theory things. So the adjoint map is something that by X I will denote elements of the Lie algebra of a group. It's just defined as follows. Well, here you can in general use an integral curve, but I always assume that I can use the exponential map to denote these things. And this G will be a group element for me, and this kind of G will be its Lie algebra, essentially. And for matrix groups, I'm acting on an element of a Lie algebra, so it's an element of a Lie algebra. Right. Sorry? So it's just that the map, and then I can evaluate this particular map on a particular element of this space. GLG is acting on G, essentially. But that's I'm not able to do at the on the blackboard, so I try to do my best. I tried a version in which I changed letter, but then I'm sure that I'm not gonna do it. And then I tried to use this three typographical reference. So we have the big G here. This is just GL, this kind of G and this G there. Okay. Well, but this is just, it was just to set the notation. Apparently I managed to confuse instead of clarifying, instead of the notation, but just the standard definition of adjoint representation. No. Well, it's just that it should be two different types of G. So here I'm not closing the G. I try to do my best, so it should be something like this. So when I don't close, it's the algebra. So I hope that won't confuse too much. But in practice, G will be group elements and X will be Lie algebra elements. I think that should be hopefully clarifying. Yes, but I'm sure that I'm not gonna do it. Yeah. Yeah, like this should be hopefully clear. Okay, but it's just the standard definition of a joint representation. And well, for matrix groups, well, as it would be just this. Okay, so the idea is that I will use a little bit of overshooting formalism over because at the end what I want is to really give you an example of infinite dimensional groups. So for kind of semi-simple groups or whatever, all the formulas that I'm gonna use, it would be, unnecessarily heavy, but I find that it's useful to understand better some of the geometry of this stuff. And well, clearly, once we have a joint representation, we can also define the joint representation for the algebra, starting from a joint representation of a group, and that's it's just something like this. And again, in practice, what matters is that it's just the usual adjoint representation. Okay. Very good. So that's one thing. But here I promise you to talk about coadjoint orbits, not adjoint orbits. And so I have to introduce the coadjoint representation. And to this end, the first thing that I have to do is to tell you how I identify the dual space to the Lie algebra G. And this is done as usual. So G star is just the space of function, of linear function on G. So I have functions that are go from G into R, and to each element x of the Lie algebra there, I add a px. So these are just linear forms on the vector space. It's the usual definition of vector space, of a dual vector space. Okay, and now, but the important thing is that I introduce this pairing, that is a pairing between the Lie algebra and its dual Lie algebra, and I can use it to define the coadjoint representation using this pairing. And the idea is that my definition of the coadjoint, the definition of coadjoint representation will be the following. So this is the object that I would like to define, and I define it simply by saying that I define it with the pairing with a joint representation. Of course, whatever P. belongs to G. Okay, great. And then starting from the definition of, so this is my definition of the coadjoint action of a group. And starting from this definition, one can also identify essentially the coadjoint action at the level of the algebra. And then the idea is that if I want to define AD star X, I can define simply this way. Or if you wish, it's the same as saying that is equal to minus P. Okay, so this is all standard things. But then with this definition, I can eventually introduce to you what is the concept of coadjoint orbit. And the idea is kind of intuitive. What do I do? A quadrant orbit. It's just I pick up an element P belonging to the dual of Lie algebra, and then I look at the set of points in the dual space, in the dual Lie algebra, that is obtained by the adjoint action of the group, the coadjoint action, sorry, of the group. And up to subtleties, that's in many cases is just defining for you a manifold. But now, so these are the objects that will be of interest for us, and then the story will be okay. So now I just give you a chain of definitions up to arrive to this one, is why this object is interesting, because I will also explain you how to put and how to define a symplectic form in a systematic way for any coadjoint orbit. Okay. And another thing that would be useful for the following is that if I have a coadjoint orbit of this type, it may be that there are some group elements for which this action is completely trivial. So the adjoint action on P just give me P itself. And this set of points is called the stabilizer, and it will play an important role. Well, or isotropy. Group, and again, the definition is pretty simple. It's just GP is equal to the set of elements in the group such that the coadjoint action is not doing anything. Well, and why this object is important? It is important because one can show that indeed the coadjoint orbits is diffeomorphic to this quotient space. And again, so this is in the idea of overshooting a bit at the beginning, because for, say, finite dimensional Lie groups, maybe this kind of identification is nice, but not necessary. While for infinite dimension, because in this case, one can easily characterize directly the geometry of these coadjoint orbits and their symplectic form. But in the case of infinite dimensional groups, understanding this will become an infinite dimensional manifold, and understanding that the geometry of an infinite dimensional manifold is complicated, so it's much more efficient to characterize orbits just by taking advantage of this characterization. So essentially you characterize all possible stability groups, and this will give you a classification of all possible orbits. And another thing to be noticed is that essentially coadjoint orbits foliates the dual space to the Lie algebra, and this is something that will come back later on. Okay, so for the moment, I just define for you what are these coadjoint orbits. Well, and another thing is that why I insisted into the difference between adjoint and coadjoint orbits is that in general, adjoint and coadjoint orbits are not equivalent. Of course, there is a well-known exception to this rule, and is given by semi-simple groups, or in general, by all groups that admits a bilinear invariant form, which is non-degenerate, among which clearly the primary examples are semi-simple groups. And in this case, actually, the two are equivalent. So you can just characterize an adjoint orbits and go and obtain information about the coadjoint orbits. So I just gonna sketch it because so that we close this kind of identity once for all. And the idea is that if I want, I can use for semi-simple groups. One can use the Killing metric to build a map such that I can build a map from the Lie algebra to the dual Lie algebra such that belongs to the algebra, and so that is kind of, and this function is just obtained starting from the Killing metric. So the idea is that in this particular case, if you have a non-degenerate Killing metric, you can use the Killing metric to play the role of this pairing that I introduced before. So you can use the Killing metric to identify elements of G and G star. And indeed, if you want to explicitly check the existence of this map, you start from the adjoint action of a given object. You act on another point, and then you use the Killing metric as a pairing, essentially. So this is just, if you wish, the definition of the adjoint, coadjoint representation in terms of the adjoint one using the Killing metric as a pairing. But then you have almost done, because if you recover the definitions that I gave before, and you use the fact that the Killing metric is G invariant, is invariant, you can, this is just the definition of the adjoint representation of the Lie algebra that I gave before, which is just the commutator, the usual commutator. Then you can move the commutator in the other position using the fact that this is the Killing metric is invariant. And essentially you have done, because this allows you to rewrite this object as being okay. So thanks to the existence of a Killing metric, then I proved the existence of an isomorphism between the two. So this is kind of again very standard exercise, but I like to repropose it also because it explains you the kind of manipulations that I will do often in the following. So just the fact of moving the coadjoint representation on the other side of the pairing to move it, to transform it into the adjoint one. So that will be a recurrent trick that I will use it in the following. And also, again, this looks still a bit formal. So let me present you a very simple example of coadjoint orbits, just to have an idea of what are these manifolds that I'm talking about. And then we will move to more complicated ones. Let's see. So the simplest non-trivial example, it's just SO3. So So I defined all this machinery, and now I want to use it to classify what are the coadjoint orbits of SO3. And later we will see a much more efficient way of doing this, but now let me do it in a pedantic way in order to see how this classification just follow from the definitions that I gave here. And so in the case of SO3, so we are talking about a matrix algebra. So this means that the adjoint representation is just given in this way, by this, with A belongs to SO3 and X belongs to its Lie algebra. And so that is just the definition of the adjoint, and I can look in this case, because I just proved you that the adjoint representation are isomorphic, so I can just look at the adjoint action on the Lie algebra, on the Lie algebra of SO3. And in order to do this, there is a simple trick. And so the idea is that I would like to identify SO3 with just R3. And the idea is just that given any vector in SO3, you can associate it to a matrix, to a rotation matrix. And the nice feature of this map is that here the Lie bracket in this kind of relation is just mapped into the vector product. And so this will allow us to identify the coadjoint orbits just by simple vectorial manipulations. And then the idea is that using this, we want to prove that the adjoint action on an element of the algebra is just given by the action of the matrix A on the associated vector V. And if I manage to prove this, this means that adjoint, and then also coadjoint, are just spheres. Okay, so I pick up a vector with a certain norm, and the adjoint action allow me to span the whole sphere of with a radius dictated by the norm of the vector. I can change the norm of the vector, and I will get another coadjoint orbit. Okay, and and now we can also prove, and once again, so it's a kind of pedantic example, but I like to show how you move directly from the definition to a characterization of the orbits, and later on we will see how to get it in a more efficient way. Okay, and so now in order to move from the from the elements of SO3, the objects with an at, to the vector, I'm just taking advantage of the map that I put it there. And so the idea is that I have to look at the joint action on a certain vector, and this will be a matrix that I can let act on a given vector belonging to R3, and this is clearly a matrix within SO3. And then I can just use this map. So this is just the definition of my adjoint action that is there. And And then these, taking advantage of the isomorphism between the two structures, I can just rewrite it in the following way. But this is just A acting on V of the tensor product of V times W, which looking at the definition is just the action of the matrix given by AW on the vector W. So then I can strip out the vector W and obtain the result that I have here. So here I characterized the adjoint action, strictly speaking, but as I told you, in this case, the two are isomorphic, and we can also check it explicitly, taking advantage of the fact that also SO3 star is isomorphic to R3, and the isomorphy is given just by say a pairing that is just given by the usual scalar product. And well, I don't have lots of space behind, so I just move here. And so again, let me use the definition that I gave you. So now I would like to see, to discover what is the adjoint action of this group, big on A. And the way to do it is to check what is the action. I act on an arbitrary vector here of SO3, element of an arbitrary, what is called the adjoint vector, so an element of the algebra, via the pairing. And then I will strip out the pairing at the end and use it to identify the action on this object. So this, just by definition of coadjoint representation, I can rewrite it in this way. Okay, and then this one is just using the kind of naive definition of the pairing that I've given there. And here I used both the definition of the pairing through the scalar product and this result that I used before. So the fact that I know what is the adjoint action on this object. And well, then it's just kind of very basic stuff. This is just, and so eventually, since this is a rotation matrix belonging to SO3, I just get the final result. So this means that my object WP that I defined here, the coadjoint orbit, in this particular case, is just given, I just repeat the definition here, it's just the coadjoint action of the elements of A on a given vector P, where A belong to SO3. This is equal to so as I said before, so in this case, the coadjoint orbits are just spheres. So any questions on this basic example? Of course, hopefully we will go to something a bit more advanced soon. Okay. So now we go back to these manifolds that are defined there. And we should try to answer the question why these manifolds are so important. Okay, and so these manifolds are so important because WP always. There's always a symplectic structure on top of it. And that is always true. And once I have a symplectic structure on this manifold, I can try, as I anticipated, to quantize them. And what does it mean, quantize them? This means construct an Hilbert space of quantum states defined on this phase space, whose phase space is just WP. And the first step, so having a defining a Poisson bracket on top of this manifold is always possible. Unfortunately, the second step is not always guaranteed. So I can always put a Poisson bracket on top of these orbits, but it's not guaranteed that I can quantize it. So that is the it's the caveat. But the WP. That can be quantized. Give you an Hilbert space H of WP, which gives a sometimes unitary, sometimes not, a representation of a group G. So now, clearly, when we want to quantize the theory, we are looking for unitary representation. But in some cases, there are also some non-unitary representations that that we can obtain starting from these orbits. And so what's I want to do in the following is to define for you this symplectic structure, which is called Kirillov constant Soryo symplectic structure, give you a brief overview of some strategies to quantize these manifolds. So it's a very quick overview of this, of the methods of geometric quantization. As I told you, there are no systematic way of quantize these manifold, and discuss some examples. So I will mainly use these methods of geometric quantization to give you an overview of what we can do in quantizing. There is another approach about you will discover more in the talk by Glenn later on, and in which you can try to have a sort of path integral approach to quantize the, these manifolds. And but I'm not gonna talk about it. But so let's go and let's try to identify this symplectic structure.
Just a second, Andrea, there is a question.
Yes.
You said something about getting a non-unitary rep from.
Yes.
What's an example where that would happen?
For instance, Virasoro. I mean, that is a bit less clear. This you can do. But some of the conjoint orbits of Virasoro, you may try to associate them to orbits that are unbounded from below, whose energy is unbounded from below, and whose unitarity is a bit unclear. So you have kind of. Negative central charges are the one that in the context of ADS3 gravity are associated to conical excesses with an excess angle of a multiple of 2 pi n. There have been some attempts to try to relate them to some of the orbits of Virasoro.
Most of what you found in the SO3 example would be non-unitary? They have the wrong radius. They have unquantized
Yeah, but let me see, you know, because, and probably there are even simpler, there are even simpler examples in the sense that you move to non-compact groups, and there somehow every finite dimensional representation that, that you can cook out is should be related to a non-unitary representation.
Right.
I would think you get all the unitary reps from quantizing orbits.
For quantizing the simple ones, yes. So in the sense, the ones that are Kähler manifolds and there are tangent cotangent bundles, yes. But the ones that usually people say it's unclear if you can quantize or not, there may be related to non-unitary ones. I mean, this usually sell as a sold as a method to get unitary representations, but there are some examples in which we can discuss. I think even in we can discuss later, but somehow there are some the examples that are considered not the standard, the ones that can be quantized with standard techniques can still be approached by other techniques, and there are indications that can give to non-unitary representations.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so let's move to the symplectic form. So what essentially do I have to do? So I have my manifold, and I have to define a non-degenerate anti-symmetric bilinear form where these objects belong to the tangent space of WT, and I want it to be a symplectic form, so it must be closed. So this is what I have to define. And in order to define it, let me spend a few words in order to identify the tangent vectors to the coadjoint orbits, because this is crucial. And once again, in some cases like compact groups, semi-simple, this is a total triviality, but let me try to develop it, to discuss about it in more generic terms, because that may be useful for more complicated groups. And so now, how to identify the tangent space, say, of WP in a generic point of the orbit, essentially. And to do it, we can just go down to the definition of a tangent vector. So I take a curve in G, tangent to a certain Lie algebra element, okay, at t equal to zero. And then I define a tangent vector in the usual way. And well, a typical example of this curve will be just this exponential map. So it's nothing deep, essentially. And now starting from this curve, I want to look at the curve that is defined in this way, which is just a curve in the coadjoint orbit, just by definition. Okay, so this is the kind of curves that I want to consider, because are integral curves that are that lies within the coadjoint orbit. And at this stage, I can repeat the trick that I have already used before. So if I want to define and identify this curve here, I just try to do it via the pairing with the Lie algebra element. So this curve lies within within G star, so within the dual to the Lie algebra, and then I can consider the pairing with the Lie algebra element. So these capital letters X, Y are always somehow Lie algebra elements within the Lie algebra. And this, by definition, is just E, the adjoint action of G to the minus one T on Y. So this is the way I'm gonna define this PT. And now I just differentiate this identity in order to try to identify what is the definition of what is a tangent vector in this a tangent vector to a point in the coadjoint orbit. And if I differentiate it, well, maybe a dot in the origin, And the advantage is that on this side of the identity, I know how to differentiate stuff. And here I just get the adjoint action on the Lie algebra. And then by definition, I obtain that this is equal to add star x on p in y. And why I'm have the right to do this, so to differentiate this identity, because this object actually belongs to the tangent space in the point q, say, to wp, but in general it belongs to the tangent space of g star, but g star is a linear space, and then I can identify it with g star itself, so they are isomorphic. And then I can essentially trade an element in G star with this somehow derivative in a given point. And the net result of this computation is just that so tangent vectors, sorry, should be, I use a dot. A tangent vector to the coadjoint orbits are just spun by the coadjoint action of the algebra. Okay, so in this sense, all infinitesimal displacement around a given point of the coadjoint orbit are just dictated by the action, by the coadjoint action of a certain Lie algebra element x. So I can find a kind of identification between infinitesimal displacement along a point in the coadjoint orbits and elements of a Lie algebra G. And that will be important in the following. Of course, the identification is not one-to-one in the sense that there will be some Lie algebra elements for which if I act on the point P, I don't do anything. So they don't induce an infinitesimal displacement simply because they will be points into the stabilizer. If you wish, in this case, there will be points on the stabilizer of the coadjoint orbits of the algebra. Okay, and not of the group, but it's a very similar concept. But still, that is something that is find important, and it is the fact that this gives you a characterization to the tangent space of a coadjoint orbit in any point. Yeah, probably I did the opposite, so let me try if I can use P and Q consistently on the right-hand side. X belongs to the algebra. Voilà. And so let me, because it's important, so tangent space by the coadjoint action. I mean, posteriori is not so surprising, this statement, but I prefer to try to prove it in a relatively step-by-step way, because that's in some cases, so this is kind of intuitive statement that is just the tangent space essentially to this object is given by the action of the Lie algebra version of the object itself, so it's kind of natural. But in the case of infinite dimensional groups, it's something that is better to check. essentially, and the same techniques should apply also in that particular context. And maybe just to conclude, let's try to see an example. Let's go back to our kind of basic example for this part of the course, that is again SO3. And in the case of SO3, what should be this tangent space? Well, it should be the tangent space to the spheres. And it's something that you can understand even geometrically. So let's check that indeed, just following this chain of definition, we indeed find the tangent sphere, tangent space to the spheres. And the idea is, as usual, in order to get this kind of geometric intuition, is that I use again the identification that I presented before. So SO3, the algebra SO3 with its Lie bracket, will be identified with R3 with just the vector product. And again, the other information that I will need is just that SO3 star will also be identified with R3 through the pairing that is given by the scalar product. Okay, so now let's use the previous result. And the previous result told me that if I do something like that, and on a generic somehow vector, I should get something of the type of this type. So here I used the previous results that allow me to substitute an element of a tangent space with the adjoint action on a point. And now I'm gonna check that I'm generating the whole tangent space to the sphere, which is what indeed we expect to be true. And but just by following the formal steps. And the formal steps is just that the definition of this object, once again, I define it just by acting on the other side of a pairing. And this object is just then this one, oops, I have a parenthesis, a commutator. So this is just the definition of a coadjoint action to the action of the, to the adjoint action on the other side of the pairing. And well, now if I go back to my bread and butter characterization of SO3 here, I can just translate it into a sequence of vector and scalar products, in the sense that this commutator is replaced by a vector product, and the pairing is just a scalar product within this object. And then it's just a matter of a very basic rules of tensor product. I can rewrite it in this particular form. But what is telling me this? Is telling me that indeed P prime of zero, well, P dot, sorry, is equal in terms of vector. So the vector corresponding to this object here is just equal to minus P dot V. And it is clearly to the sphere identified by the action of A on P. So we confirm that for SO3, my coadjoint orbits are just spheres, and the tangent space here is spanned by objects that take the form of adjoint action of objects. Okay. Okay, yeah. Now I'm pretty slow, so just a couple of minutes here. Yes, left. Okay, so now we checked all of these, and now eventually I can give you the definition of a symplectic form. So now I characterize for you what is the in a given point Q of WP, and I characterize for you what are the tangent vectors to the orbit, so I can just use them. So these are two generic elements in the tangent space of the orbit WP in the point Q. And the definition is just the following. Okay. So the fact that it is anti-symmetric, well, it's clearly manifest that this object is anti-symmetric. The other properties are maybe less obvious, the fact that it's closed. So I thought to show you that it's closed, but since I'm not particularly fast, I propose to skip in case if you are interested, we can look at it later. In general, you can look, for instance, at Marzen ratio. That was the first reference that I gave. If you are interested in the details to show that it is that this object is a closed two-form, and which is non-degenerate as well. The non-degeneracy is kind of easy because, well, you just look at the form. In order to get zero for an arbitrary x, it's impossible to get a zero here for all y's in case x is different from zero. And the closure is likely is not so difficult, but it takes a bit of time to do it. And once we have this closed non-degenerate symplectic form, so the crucial condition is that d omega is equal to zero and that it is non-degenerate. I can define a Poisson bracket. And essentially the idea is that okay. And that is the object I wish to quantize. But before quantizing it, we take a pause. And after the break, I will show you why this object is giving you an irreducible representation that a priori is not irreducible of a group G. Okay, so thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Is there like any urgent question?
Yes, there is a question in the chat, Andrea, for you, which is, just give me a second, sorry. What is the relation between the symplectic form you've written and the cross product in the case of SO3?
In the cross product? I don't know. I have no idea. So at least this object is the cross product. And so you can use the cross product to define it, but it's nothing deep. So, I mean, this SO3 clearly is a very basic example, so don't trust it too much. It was just to show that from very formal definitions, you can arrive to something that is really pretty concrete somehow. But the techniques are not particularly universal in that particular example somehow. Exactly.
So, just will you repeat for
the volume form on the sphere is the symplectic form. Okay. Says Anthony Speranza, they should talk with the microphone.
Yeah. Okay. No, but the comment was that the volume form on the sphere is just my symplectic object there.
Okay. Awesome. So let's meet in 10 minutes for the second part of the lecture. Thanks again.
Thank you.